anything else. Congratulations! You just learned in about 2 minutes of our audio program what takes a third of a term in a typical accounting course. Back to the matter at hand here with checklist item number 4, we're actually in search of net profit margin. Net profit margins of 7% or greater. What is net profit margin? Well, it's just those net profits, that net income, as a percentage of sales. You take that bottom line, profits, and divide it by the top line, sales. Our foolish requirement is that the companies we follow should show a minimum net profit margin of 7%, which is another way of saying that on every dollar of sales, we want to see the company generate 7 pennies or more of profit. Why is that? Well, we fools prefer this figure to be high because a high net profit margin indicates a company that is either soundly beating its competition or, fool's choice, has no competition at all. In our capitalistic world, a high net profit margin is an achievement, a mark of excellence. Foolish checklist item number 5 of the 8 things we're looking for in a small cap growth stock. Number 5 is a relative strength of 90 or higher. Foolish requirement number 5 introduces one of our very favorites, relative strength. Relative strength rates the performance of a stock over the past year against every other stock listed on our major markets. The rating system gives a numerical grade, just like the grade you would have received in the classroom, to the performance of a stock over the past 12 months. The range is actually 1 to 99. Let's take an example. A relative strength of 95 indicates a stock that has outperformed 95% of all other American stocks over the past year. That's a wonderful performance. Relative strength is a momentum indicator. It shows you at a quick glance how well a company's stock has done relative to all the others on the market over a given year. How do you find relative strength? The most convenient place to locate it is the newspaper Investor's Business Daily, which every day prints that figure, the relative strength, for every stock on the market. Why do we like relative strength? Why do we look for a high relative strength in the small cap growth stocks we're searching out? The answer is simple. We believe in general that the winners keep on winning. Most of the time that a company has achieved great stock market performance, that reflects 2 things. First, that the company is doing something really right with its business. And second, importantly, that the stock market recognizes the company's great performance. All other things remaining equal, the winners keep on winning, and good companies are good for a good reason. Foolish checklist item number 6 is that a company have earnings and sales growth, both of those, 25% or greater. Well, this 6 foolish requirement calls for a company we're following to demonstrate strong growth in sales and earnings. As I said, of at least 25% or more when compared to the same period the year before. Corporate financial statements are prepared and published 4 times a year, at 3-month intervals called quarters. You should be following your stocks at least this often so that you're on top of your company's developing story. Why do we look for growth in sales and earnings? Because growth in one or the other is not enough. We want to see a company growing its business and growing the profits it generates from its business. Foolish checklist item number 7, insider holdings of 10% or more. Earlier in our audio program, I mentioned how many small companies have significant ownership from the people who created the company and are still running it. That's in general a good thing. It means that they have skin in the game just as you would have skin in the game if you bought the stock. We fools typically prefer to see at least 10% of a small cap growth company owned by its management, if not a good deal more. And finally, foolish checklist item number 8 when we look for good small company growth stocks is that a company have positive cash flow from operations. Let me explain. Cash flow is a measure of the movement of money through a business. It's reported in the statement of cash flow that usually appears at the end of a company's financial statements. We want this number to be positive. Well, what does positive operational cash flow mean? It means that at the end of the day, over the course of running its business, the company has managed to generate cash, which would be a positive number, rather than consume it, which would be indicated by a negative cash flow number. You want your companies to crank out free cash from doing their operations, making the necessary funds available for internal expansion, for acquisitions, dividend payments, or whatever. A company that has negative cash flow, that is, it sends more money out the door over the course of a year than it takes in, has to borrow money in order to maintain and grow its business. For a small company, that's a discouraging indication that the company will have to either take on debt, borrow money for the short or long term, or issue more shares of stock, diluting the all-important earnings per share and diluting your ownership if you own some. Positive cash flow indicates that a company's destiny is in its own hands. They are generating cash, which they can use to grow their business without asking for handouts from anyone else. That's why it is the critical final part of our Foolish 8 checklist. And that concludes our list of 8 things to look for when selecting a top small-cap growth stock. This next section is about digging in. Digging deep into a company's financial statements, and departing with a firm understanding of how financial statements can help you make investment decisions for and against the companies whose reports you come across. But we're bringing more than just our pickaxe. We also have crashed this party with our handheld weeder. That's because although it's all very good to break a sweat digging profitably through the numbers, you'll save yourself even more time if you know how to weed out the meaningless stuff and spend all your time examining what counts. Let's do that together. Okay, so it's time to make sense of income statements. Let's examine some foolish indicators that we seek in every statement of operations. Again, these can be found in the company's annual report, 10Q, or 10K. First, make sure margins remain at consistent levels, if they're not actually rising. A company's profitability directly affects its stock price, mainly through the vehicle of earnings per share, which we sometimes abbreviate to EPS, earnings per share. If a company's margins, that is, the level of profitability like net profit margin which we covered earlier, if those decline, that decline translates directly to the bottom line, to the earnings per share. That decline will in turn dramatically affect the performance of a stock. We prefer margins, the level of profitability of a company, to remain at the same levels, or even better, of course, rise slightly and consistently over time. This is the sign of good management and a healthy competitive enterprise. You should attempt to reach an understanding, of course, of the reasons behind any significant change in a company's financial statements, just as you would in your own bank account. The second thing we look for as we make sense of income statements is to make sure that research and development expenditures, the R&D a company pays out, that those aren't getting shortchanged. Research and development is simply the bucks you supply to a few mad scientists hidden away somewhere in the bowels of your corporate headquarters. Who's going to notice if you happen to shortchange these guys for a quarter or a year, right? Well, the answer is a fool, that's who, because we watch very carefully the amounts our companies are spending on R&D, particularly high-tech and medical companies, which rely so much on developing the superior technology that will put everyone else out of business. For example, if a company happens to have spent less on research and development in 2001 than it did in the year 2000, that's quite a bad sign. And it suggests that management may consciously have underfunded its development efforts in order to prop up its earnings per share that year. It is possible, of course, that a company's R&D needs can change, permanently reducing the amount spent, but it's quite unlikely for a small, high-growth situation. Anyway, your job will be to find out. And let me also mention that you can take those R&D expenses as a percentage of sales. Rather than just isolating the figure on its own, how about comparing it to what portion of the company's sales it's spent in R&D expenses for a given year? That's a helpful percentage to follow. The third thing we look for as we make sense together of income statements are to make sure that the company we're looking at is paying full income taxes. Always look at your company's corporate tax rate. You can deduce this quite easily. Just take the amount paid in income taxes for the period as a percentage of the income before taxes. 32-33% is fine. It's about what one would expect. The reason we make a point of talking about income taxes here is that some companies record much lower income tax rates due to what are called tax loss carryforwards. This happens when our government gives money-losing enterprises credits against future taxes when and if they eventually turn a profit. We simply caution you to make sure you're not using artificially high net income and earnings per share figures if the company was using an artificially low tax rate, in most cases below 20%. If the company continues to succeed over time, you can expect they'll eventually be paying about one-third of their income in taxes. So factor that into your thinking. The fourth thing we're going to do as we make sense together of income statements is we're going to keep an eye on the growth in a company's total number of shares outstanding. Companies issue more shares of their common stock when they need to create cash. Reasons to issue new stock abound. Some companies need the bucks to fund expansion. Others might issue new shares to pay off a new acquisition. Whatever the reason, whenever new stock is issued, the existing stock, of course, becomes proportionately devalued by the market. As mentioned earlier, when we settle into the process of actually valuing stocks, earnings per share is an important figure for investors to watch. So obviously, when a company issues more shares, the earnings per share will decline, all other things remaining equal. Suffice it to point out now that you should scrutinize total shares outstanding. If you see significant increases or hear of a new company share offering, always ask yourself, why? Did your company want to cash in off a high share price following a great run in its stock, implying that maybe management thinks the stock is too richly valued today? Or did it need the money, say, to launch a new subsidiary, which would be good, or to stay in business, which would be bad? If you see a large unexplained jump in the company's share total, or a consistent pattern over 3 to 5 years of significantly more and more and more shares, your guys are diluting the growth of their earnings per share. You can probably find better investments and better managed companies elsewhere. Now that you've got a handle on the income statement, here's a quick word on one of the most common methods that people use to evaluate stocks, the price-to-earnings ratio, or P/E ratio, which we think of as the market's price tag. P/E equals the price of a stock divided by its company's earnings per share over the past 12 months. Let's talk about how to calculate it. For a given stock, you take the price per share of that stock listed in your newspaper or in an online quote, and then you find out the earnings per share of the company. Here's an example. If a stock is trading at $35 a share, and you find out, by doing some research, that it has $1.75 in earnings per share, you simply take 35 and divide it by $1.75. Again, you take the price per share of 35 and divide it by the company's earnings per share of $1.75. If you're doing the math with me, you'll realize that's a price-to-earnings ratio of 20. Think of the P/E ratio as the price tag that the market has put on the shares. Buying stocks that trade at 35 times earnings or higher, as do many of the best growth stocks, is akin to shopping at Tiffany, high prices for desired goods. Purchasers of stocks whose P/E ratios are 10 times or less have opted to shed their discretionary income on the equity equivalent of a blue light special. The less you pay up to buy a stock, the lower your risk. However, the price-to-earnings ratio need not and often does not correspond between stocks. Some stocks may be considered underpriced at 50 times earnings, whereas others may be grossly overpriced when their P/E rises to 12. This is because the market's price tag is based on many factors, including past history, present circumstance, future projections, and importantly, the industry the company works in. All of these, of course, vary from company to company. Typically, an automobile manufacturer has a price-to-earnings ratio in the single digits, maybe 5 or 6. By contrast, a typical high-technology company that's profitable has a price-to-earnings ratio of 30 or higher. The foolish lesson on PEs: they need to be placed in a context that gives them meaning. And here's where a very general rule of thumb comes in handy. In a fully and fairly valued situation, a growth stock's price-to-earnings ratio should equal the percentage of the growth rate of its company's earnings. This is the basis for what we call the fool ratio. You calculate it by taking a stock's current PE ratio as a percentage of its growth rate. For this reason, some analysts call it the price-to-earnings-to-growth ratio, or PEG, PEG. Let's go back to our example earlier of the company that had a PE of 20. Well, if that price-to-earnings ratio of 20 is compared to the company's growth rate in sales and earnings, which let's say is 25% per year, 20 divided by 25 gives you a PEG of 0.80. That means, again, that a company's price-to-earnings ratio is slightly below the company's growth rate. What to do with that number? Well, we said that the fool ratio, or PEG ratio, takes as its basis that the price-to-earnings ratio and the growth rate of a company would be equal when a stock is fully and fairly valued. That means that a PEG of 1 would indicate full valuation. Anything less than 1, like the example I just gave, where the PE ratio is 20 and the company's growth rate is 25%, anything less than 1 would point out that the expected growth rate has sped ahead of the PE, which means that the stock is selling for less than its growth rate would normally demand. A fool ratio of more than 1 indicates a stock that is more expensive than you would expect, based on its growth rate. The key point to take away, and the reason we even bother mentioning this ratio, is that for companies with profits, you can get a pretty good gauge on how their stocks are being priced according simply to their percentage growth rates. How frequently do I hear someone say, a stock has a PE of 60? What a high number! How overvalued it is! Well, if the sustainable growth rate for that enterprise over the next 3 to 5 years is higher than 60%, per year, well, we just don't think it's that overvalued. Use the ratio carefully. It ultimately provides only an impression of a stock's valuation. It's then up to you to determine why the market has that impression. Okay, I've given a basic picture of the income statement up to this point. Let's now move on to the second financial statement that we watch. It's called the balance sheet. Unlike the income statement, which reads like a top-down, year-long story of a business's progress, the balance sheet gives you a single snapshot of the company's books on the last day of the reporting period. The statement comprises two sections. You may have heard of them before: assets and liabilities. When reviewing a company's balance sheet, there are three things to look for. Let's go over each. The first is, look for cash. Cash is very, very likable. In fact, it's the very first line of the balance sheet, right up top in the assets. It's always named cash and cash equivalents, or some similar phrase. This is the amount of money a company has sitting in the bank. If you're an experienced investor, you already knew that. It's no surprise to you. If you're someone who's new to our subject, you might be surprised to find out that's all it is. How easy it is for you and I to figure out the actual cash balance in the bank for any company publicly traded today on our markets. The access that we have to information today is astounding. Information really is power, so let's use it. Our only real rule with company cash is that we like to see lots of it. Companies build up cash for several reasons. The first one is the best of all. Good operations generate cash. But there are other ways to come by cash as well. A common one is a share offering. We have mentioned companies that issue more shares of common stock in order to raise cash. When those offerings occur, the resultant cash comes right to this asset line. But cash means more than just a dependable rock-bottom stock price. It also represents the power to pay off debts, if a company has them. Or it could represent the potential to acquire complementary businesses, or buy out a competitor. The best growth companies on the planet create future growth with their own cash. Develop a bias towards stocks backed by cash-generating businesses that have a wad of bills sitting in the bank gathering interest and ready to be deployed whenever a good opportunity presents itself. Item number two, as we peruse the balance sheet of any given company, is that it avoid too much debt. The opposite of cash is long-term debt. Like people taking out 30-year mortgages, many companies also borrow to fund future opportunities. Long-term debt, if it exists, is an item found midway down the liability side of the balance sheet, just after current liabilities, those that are inside of 12 months. Long-term debt is just one of the financing tools available to companies across the planet. It's not always completely horrible to expand rapidly through the use of debt, but it is a dangerous game. We vastly prefer businesses that don't take on much debt, if any. We like them to be so profitable from operations and growing so rapidly that they don't need the risk of significant interest expenses. They don't need additional capital beyond what they're generating to thrive. And the third and final item we'll look at on the balance sheet is to make sure that growth in accounts receivable and inventory approximates sales growth. Accounts receivable and inventory both constitute assets, insofar as both represent money that the company would receive if it were liquidated. Accounts receivable measures the amount of money that a business is owed by its customers, not all of whom pay 100% cash up front for every product. Inventories are an asset because they represent finished or near-finished products that the company simply has not yet sold. They're sitting on a shelf somewhere. Now, when accounts receivable and inventories for a company that you hold are rising at a significantly higher rate than the sales of the company, or they demonstrate a huge one-quarter jump, you need to consider very seriously whether you want to remain in that investment. Accounts receivable, the amount of money a company is owed by people who purchased its product but haven't put cash up yet, accounts receivable in particular are worthy of your scrutiny and respect as a financial indicator. We've seen many otherwise healthy small-cap stocks literally fall apart, lose 80% or more of their value quickly, because they failed over time to collect what they were supposedly owed, creating a huge cash flow drain. Monitor very closely accounts receivable and inventory and make sure that even if they're growing, which is acceptable, they're not growing significantly faster than the company's sales. Now let's talk about some of the ratios you can find on a balance sheet, which you might find useful. Some people go overboard analyzing the various ratios calculable from the data in a balance sheet. We don't find many of these terribly meaningful, but we will share with you here a couple of things you can learn. The most common ratio associated with balance sheets is probably the current ratio. The current ratio provides an investor with a basic test of short-term liquidity, that is, a company's ability to get cash to make quick payments if and when it needs to. You simply take the current assets, which are the cash, the accounts receivable and inventories we just mentioned, etc., and you divide those by the current liabilities, which are accounts payable, accrued expenses, and other ways that the company still must make payments to others. Ideally, this figure, the current ratio, will fall somewhere above 2-to-1 for the typical American industrial company, tending toward higher ratios than that for small caps. What the current ratio might tell you additionally is how nimbly a company may be able to act to take advantage of an unforeseen circumstance. A second ratio, very similar to the current ratio, is called the quick ratio. The quick ratio is more cash-centric. It is simply the current assets minus inventory divided by the current liabilities. Very similar to the current ratio, it just doesn't include inventory. It gives you an even better read on how prepared a company might be to encounter unforeseen difficulties or opportunities, or just to meet current short-term debt obligations if those are relevant. So you want to see here a quick ratio as high as possible. Another fairly common ratio is the debt-to-equity ratio. As you know, companies issue bonds or shares of stock in order to raise money. One of the fundamental differences between debt, like bank borrowings or bonds, and equity, or stock, is that debt has to be repaid. If a company maintains little debt, it retains the ability to go out to the capital markets and float a bond or convertible in order to raise cash, should the need arise. You want this figure, the debt-to-equity ratio, to be as low as possible, with zero being the preference in most cases, meaning the company has no debt. A final ratio I'll mention here is perhaps the most important, but again, not one upon which I would found any investment decision. It's called the return on equity ratio, one additional measure of corporate profitability. Earlier, we talked about net profit margin, the pennies on a dollar of sales that are profits. Well, here's a separate way of looking at profits. For this one, you divide that net income, the bottom line, by what's called the total stockholders' equity from the balance sheet. It's actually the bottom line of the balance sheet. By so doing, by dividing the net income by the total stockholders' equity, you are measuring the amount of profit that a business generates relative to the amount of money shareholders have put into the company. A respectable figure here is 15%. A strong figure runs over 20%. As with most of these ratios, you want to see a high number that remains high over time, either by standing pat or, even better, increasing. Having drawn to an end of our foolish overview of the balance sheet, I'll close our discussion of making sense of the financial info by turning to the cash flow statement. By now, you've already heard about cash flow. We've stressed the importance of positive operational cash flow earlier in our audio program. We ascribe profound importance to a business's ability to spin off, not consume, cash. Your own portfolio should be replete with, if not totally dominated by, cash generators. Novices sometimes have difficulty conceiving of the cash flow statement. If it's measuring income and expenses, well, how is it any different from the income statement? The answer is that the cash flow statement simply provides you a different way of looking at income and expenses. The statement of cash flows is most akin, in fact, to your own monthly bank statement. The various income and expense items that show up there are all accounted for when paid. So it's the real money going in and going out exactly when it actually does go in and go out. That's in direct contrast to the income statement. Remember, on the income statement, the top line is sales. A company will list its sales even when it hasn't been paid the cash yet, in many cases. Now, the statement of cash flows is most useful when you want to focus on the guts of a business. The guts of a business reveal exactly when and what money is going out and when and what money is coming in. That's exactly what a cash flow statement shows and why we watch this report so carefully. As investors, we like to see the cash and cash equivalents line increase with the passage of time. I think I've made that clear. It's to the statement of cash flows that you go to understand why, or why not, a company's cash is increasing. The cash flow statement gives you the opportunity to see what's going on in a company's bank account. Take advantage of this by poring over the statement and formulating a notion of what's working financially and what isn't. We would be remiss if in our discussion of a company's financial statements, we didn't point you to probably our favorite part of a company's annual report or 10K or 10Q. What's that? It's the management's discussion of liquidity and capital resources. Yuck! Listen to those words. I hate having to say them. They sound so dry and boring. But let me make it clear, this is really the heart of a company's annual report. They're required by law to make it appear in their annual report, This write-up will make for the best few paragraphs of substantive reading you'll get anywhere in a company's information packet. Here you have the opportunity to hear straight from management how it will manage its cash and finances in the year ahead. You'll learn the size of any credit lines that your company has established at banks, and how far, if any, it has drawn off those lines. You'll sometimes get estimates of a company's capital expenditures, how much they'll be spending to buy new factories or build their product lines over the next year, and explanations of how the company will fund those expenditures. For example, operating cash flows would be the best explanation of how. In short, this section, the management discussion of liquidity and capital resources, provides you a nice read on a company's immediate financial future in no fluff talk. Whew! Okay, that's it. For now, by learning how to digest and understand the most important parts of financial statements, what we've been doing together over the last half hour or so, you're just about prepared to invest foolishly. For more information on anything having to do with reading financial statements or to get direct interactive help, just come to our website at fool.com, where we have a live ongoing discussion with customer service for people who want to learn. Now let's consider which is more important, the quality of a company or the market's valuation of that company. In outlining some methods for identifying investment possibilities and some basic metrics that you may want to use to assess them, we've covered two types of companies, large caps and small caps. In this part of our audio program, I'd like briefly to summarize our favorite strategies, such as the rule maker approach, my brother Tom invests this way, and rule breaker investing, I invest this way. Let me also mention that from Simon & Schuster is our 1999 bestseller, Rule Breakers, Rule Makers, which is also available as an audiobook. Here's a quick summary of that material. The basic premise is that you're looking for the greatest companies in the world today. They are either the rule makers, which we think of as legal monopolies, those that dominate their industries for years and provide huge profit streams, or they are rule breakers, upstart companies that you identify early on as entities that can potentially slay Goliath and create huge shareholder value in faster amounts of time. We therefore look at the world of business this way. Every great business begins as a rule breaker and hopes to transition in time to eventually dominate its industry, often an industry the company helped to create, ascending to the throne as rule maker. With both approaches, we focus first and foremost on the quality of the businesses that lie behind the stocks we buy. We don't get hung up on the valuation. The 20th century showed that if the true underlying quality of a company goes up, eventually the valuation of that company rises to meet it. We therefore largely ignore the weekly fluctuation of stock prices and instead concentrate on the merits and shortcomings of the actual business. If you can find the best managed, most profitable companies with increasing potential, tomorrow morning's share price shouldn't concern you. Your game is to win over 25 years, and the way to make the most money on the stock market is to find the companies that over the next 25 years will grow to dominate their industries. Again, our aim is to find companies that we want to own, with whom we want to be partners, perhaps for the remainder of our lives. Some of our investments will perform poorly, others moderately well, and some we expect will dominate. That mix should turn $20,000 literally into millions of dollars in a handful of decades. But if you're going to invest in stocks, shouldn't you want to work very hard to determine the fair value of a company like Williams-Sonoma, or a business like Tootsie Roll, or a stock like TCBY Yogurt? Our unusual answer to that one is, well, only if it helps you sleep at night. We say this because our quite contrary take is that any intense process designed around arriving at a present-day fair price for a given stock greatly underrates the long-term merits of the business that underlies it. Because of the myriad reasons for the financial industry to be concentrated on what's happening today, the context of historical performance gets left behind. One share of Coca-Cola, purchased at its IPO in 1919 for $40, was worth $6.7 million 80 years later, with dividends reinvested. If we grant that finding companies like Coca-Cola is a challenge, will you grant that if you can find them, worrying about their P.E. ratio today or their projected cash flows over the next 5 years or the images on their stock graph is worrying about something that more often than not will end up being inconsequential for the long term? We submit to you then, dear fool, that valuation isn't half so important as quality and the durability of the business model. In fact, we'll go so far as to say that the quality of the company is at least a degree of magnitude more important than the immediate value of its stock price. We've dubbed this principle QAVA. QAVA stands for our belief that quality, the QA, comes before valuation, the VA. This isn't to say that we'll shield our eyes from the stock price, nor is it to say that we don't attend to the intermediate-term performance of a stock. Nope, we'll confess to doing both of those things. We will say, however, that in our investment portfolio, we'll be concentrating our work on the strength of the businesses that we own and searching for clues about their viability over the next 10 years. So we're business-focused investors, not stock-focused investors. Remember that term, QAVA. Remember the order of its two elements. Now, certainly this runs contrary to much of what we see on financial television today and read in our newspapers and magazines. By largely ignoring the stock price and its valuation and concentrating instead on the business and on its performance in its industry, we'll make some timing mistakes as investors. We'll sometimes buy a stock at 40 times earnings, a P.E. of 40, that 6 months later could have been had for 25 times earnings after a strong quarterly earnings performance but a broad market decline of 20%. Darn! But other times we'll get lucky, buying a stock for 25 times earnings that quickly zooms to 40 times earnings on a handful of new partnership agreements. You see, we think that in 10 years and 20 years, the single best way to grow your savings is to become a part owner of the very best businesses that you can, with management committed to enduring growth for their shareholders. If you choose right, that growth will compound in your portfolio for a long, long time. This has been the case for outfits like Hershey, Microsoft, IBM, General Electric, Sears, Walmart, and Disney. The 20th century in America provided enormous long-term opportunity for public corporations and their shareholders. We expect the same in our new century. And for that reason, we're going to go out in search of long-term quality, not inexpensive pricing in the short term. The old saw of buy low, sell high has too many people concentrated on the when of investing. Most of us should not be focused on the when, but on the what. This too runs against conventional wisdom, for the highest quality businesses are the best performers over time, but also happen to appear overvalued frequently by traditional valuation measures all the way up. I mentioned earlier we're going to look at rule makers and rule breakers. Let's begin with rule makers. Rule maker investing makes a good starting point for new investors since it's focused on big companies, huge companies, that rule their industries. Viewed from the rule maker's perspective, all small companies are constantly in danger of blowing up and dropping to zero. As established behemoths, rule makers are in little danger of going belly up anytime soon. In fact, they have, by definition, realized spectacular gains in the past through excellent business performance. In this section, we'll offer you a list of attributes that rulemakers share. Please note that these guidelines are loosely drawn. They're not hard and fast rules. Very few companies will satisfy every one of these, and the few that do may be unsuitable for other reasons. The rulemaker criteria rest on the premise that understanding a company's business, both its location and its direction, is essential to successful investing. the following 11 guidelines aim to help you synthesize the essential elements of a company's business model. Rarely will a company ace all of these criteria, but the best rulemakers fulfill most of them. Finally, rulemaker analysis is both qualitative and quantitative in nature. The first 5 criteria I'll present focus on qualitative aspects of a company's business. The second 6 are numerical metrics based on the company's financials. We'll use some terms that you've already learned earlier in the program. Together, these 11 guidelines serve as the basic measures of excellence for evaluating rulemakers. So, without further ado, here are the 11 rulemaker essentials. Rulemaker essential number 1, dominant brand. True rulemakers are looking to establish a direct connection with billions of consumer minds, day in and day out. They'd like to draw a clear distinction between their product and the generic competing brand. For example, when you ask for a hanky during allergy season, there's a good chance you'll call for a Kleenex. And when you head out to buy a pair of jeans next month, you might tell a friend, "I'm going to buy some Levi's." When a product achieves that instant recognition, that consumer habit, it is foolishly said, that's with a capital F, to have mind share. And when this happens en masse, you have an increasingly defensible business, right? Having one product with mind share, or better yet, several, is the first sign of a rulemaker business. Rulemaker essential number 2, repeat purchase business. We love these businesses because every time a sale is made, the customer is reminded once again of the value of the company's product. The more often this free advertising occurs, the better. A product that is used often but purchased infrequently, such as software or an automobile, benefits from frequent and hopefully positive customer contact. However, future income is more predictable when the product or service is actually repurchased often. Please note that this should not be interpreted to mean that software or technology companies can't be rulemakers. On the contrary, Microsoft and Intel, for example, are huge rulemakers. Their high gross and profit margins make it easy to overlook any disadvantage that comes from the relatively infrequent purchase of their products, especially since most buyers of their products use them almost daily. Rulemaker essential number 3, convenience. To establish rulemaker authority, a business must position its products as the most accessible and convenient in their industry. History shows that in virtually every consumer sector, there are few ways to overrate the value of being the leader in convenience for customers, whether it's buying mid-level shelf space in a supermarket, placing the gas station 50 yards closer to the exit ramp, delivering books right to the doorstep, selling coffee on the corner, or preloading software on a computer. Convenience for the customer is crucial to a company's long-term success. Try to determine if a given company provides the most accessible products or services in its industry. The gold star goes only to companies with best-of-class convenience. Rulemaker essential number 4, and again, these first 5 are all qualitative. Number 4 is expanding possibilities. Even more important than the past is, of course, the future. We're looking for companies with a direction that's even sweeter than its present location. Sure, historical performance leads us to some great companies, but we need to think seriously about a company's future prospects. Is the world going to be buying Pokemon in 2010? Does Coca-Cola's brand name have staying power? Are video rental stores going out of business? You'll want to probe your own habits, your own thoughts, read through the company's statements, and ask questions on our Motley Fool discussion boards at Fool.com to decide if the business you're studying has staying power. When in doubt, try asking yourself the following questions. First, do my friends know about and use the company's products? And second, is worldwide expansion believable for their stuff? An interesting question to ask yourself, for example, is, can Starbucks expand internationally? That's a great subject for debate. Rulemaker essential number 5, your familiarity and interest. How does your interest and familiarity with a corporation improve its chances of excelling? Well, it doesn't really. This requirement, rather than being applied to public companies, is applied to you, the investor. It proposes that you'll dramatically improve your chances of scoring above-average investment returns if you concentrate on companies you'll enjoy following. Whether it's dedicated to the business of NASCAR racing, selling sandwiches, or manufacturing personal computers, a company will more likely serve you well if you know it well. Now, for the following six criteria, we'll turn to the quantitative side of business analysis. Rulemaker essential number six, sales growth of at least 10% year over year. Sales growth is the most fundamental indication of an expanding business. We're looking for companies that are growing sales, aka revenue, by at least 10% per year. Now, don't confuse this with the 25% growth we mentioned earlier in our program, which we apply to finding the best small-cap growth companies. Remember, here we're looking at rule makers, huge companies, and we'd like to see sales growth of at least 10% for those year over year. A handy mathematical rule of thumb to calculate this 10% more growth, just take a company's income statement and divide the current year's sales by the previous year's sales and subtract 1. Rulemaker essential number 7, gross margins of at least 50%. Rulemaker investors will rarely make a long-term commitment to a company that isn't profitable. Gross margins show what money is left from revenue after the cost of those goods sold is subtracted. We want to see gross margins poking up above the rather lofty perch of 50%. In other words, we'd like the company's cost of making its product or providing its service to be no more than half the price of what it sells at. To calculate gross margins, again from the income statement and company reports, divide gross profits by sales. We're looking for that number, the gross margin, to be above 50%. Rulemaker essential number 8, net profit margins of at least 10%. Well, we just talked about gross profit margin. Now we're talking about bottom line net profit margin. Reflecting on gross margin, it's nice to know that a company can sell its products for double the cost of producing them, but that'd be of little positive consequence if the promotion and overhead expenses associated with that product ended up wiping out the profits. We want the company to still earn good money, even if they pay out $1 million for that advertisement on the Super Bowl. Therefore, our next objective is that net profit margins be at least 10%. Again, earlier we covered this figure and we used 7%. That figure we apply to small cap growth companies. For rule makers, the huge dominant profitable companies, we want to see net profit margins of at least 10%. To refresh, the calculation is just net income after all expenses, including taxes, marketing, and administrative expenses, and so forth, net income divided by sales. Rulemaker essential number 9, cash no less than 1.5 times total debt. We say it of your personal finances, and we'll say it of rulemaker companies. We'd prefer the financial statements to show little or no debt. Because most companies will and must borrow money at some point, we don't want to cross off our list all businesses with some debt on their balance sheet. Therefore, we require that a rulemaker's cash be at least 1.5 times greater than their total debt, including both long-term and short-term debt. So, if and when bad things do occur, the company has ample and immediate cash resources to deal with the problem. For example, a rulemaker that has $1 billion of cash in its bank account may have up to $600 million or so of debt and still fulfill our criteria of having at least 1.5 times more cash than total debt. Make no mistake about it. Over the course of a decade or two or three, bad things will happen to every company, even the greatest ones. You remember New Coke? How about Microsoft's MSN Online? Version 1.0. Things can and will go wrong. That's why we want companies with the cash to buy themselves out of that trouble when it comes knocking on the door. Rulemaker Essential Number 10, a foolish flow ratio below 1.25. Next up, we want to see efficient use of that cash. In the day-to-day management of a company's operation, money is going to rush through the front door from sales, and it's going to fly out the window and the back door from expenses. Businesses survive on cash. We want our companies to bring money in quickly, but to pay it out slowly. More cash coming in today, less cash going out today. But you ask, well, how can we possibly measure that? Well, with a little something that we call the foolish flow ratio, developed by my brother Tom. The foolish flow enables you to cut through accounting shenanigans and artfully constructed income statements to get a clear snapshot of how a company is managing its cash. The simple calculation is this: current assets minus cash divided by current liabilities minus short-term debt. Current assets minus cash, that's the numerator. Well, cash means cash and equivalents and marketable securities and short-term investments as found on the company balance sheet. Short-term debt, which is subtracted in the denominator, again, current liabilities minus short-term debt. Short-term debt means notes payable and the current portion of long-term debt. That's also from the company's balance sheet. Guidelines for the numbers? We accept flow ratios that run lower than 1.25, ideally below 1. If they get below 1, that means the business is able to delay more payments than it's carrying in costs of inventory and unpaid bills. The foolish flow ratio provides you an easy way, a one-stop, one-number solution to evaluate how well a company's management treats its cash. For a rulemaker, that is crucial. Rulemaker Essential Number 11. It's that a company's cash king margin be at least 10%. Whoa, what are the fools doing again? They're creating another term that they have to explain. Well, we do take a creative approach to understanding companies, and we like to share with you the way that we look at the business world, and the cash king margin is yet another example. The cash king margin follows in the footsteps of what I just mentioned, our foolish flow ratio, by revealing important truths about the cash dynamics of a business without unnecessary complexity. The cash king margin is the equivalent of the standard net profit margin we've discussed earlier, except that it measures profits by using the cash flow statement instead of the income statement. But fools, what's the difference, you say? Everything in the world. While standard net margins are important, what hits the bank account at the end of the day, cash as measured by the cash flow statement, is a lot more real from an economic standpoint. The cash king margin lets us shove all that income statement stuff aside and see what really happens to the money that the company is bringing in via sales. Here's how the cash king margin is calculated. It's this: operating cash flow minus capital expenditures, that figure divided by sales. To calculate the cash king margin, you need only two line items taken directly from a company's cash flow statement: operating cash flow and capital expenditures. With only a little practice, your eyes will soon clue in directly on these two important numbers, and all the other numbers will fade to the background. Finally, then, it'll probably come as no surprise that rulemakers tend to be enormous in size. This is not so much a criterion as a mere statement of fact. We tend not to look for rulemaker companies with anything less than $1 billion in annual sales. And we look for companies with a total value, or market capitalization, of at least $5 billion. Most rulemakers have sales figures and market caps substantially larger than $1 billion and $5 billion respectively, but those are good baseline numbers. That's the foolish take on rulemakers. Now, let's look at rule breakers. On August 4th, 1994, an obscure real money public stock portfolio opened up shop and announced its intention to purchase shares of America Online. With no one in particular taking notice, we bought America Online that day at a now split-adjusted price of 46 cents a share. Less than 6 years later, the stock traded at 60. Our $1,848 then had appreciated to $241,080, a gain of 12,900%. We bought Amazon.com in the summer of 1997 at a split-adjusted $3.19 a share. That was several months after its strong initial public offering, or IPO, and Money Magazine had in fact recently published an article about how overvalued the stock was at that price. 3 years later, Amazon.com stood at 38, so that our $8,408 had turned into $100,158, a gain of 1,091%. These companies were classic rule breakers. They both possessed the six attributes shared by all revolutionary capitalistic enterprises that'll lead to the greatest returns the stock market has to offer. Coca-Cola, Walmart, Microsoft, Cisco, and Starbucks. The best stocks of the past century all began as flat-out rule breakers. But oh, by the way, maybe you were a customer of our website, Fool.com, when we purchased ATC Communications for the rule breaker portfolio. It was the autumn of 1996. The stock was riding high with its telecom services peers, and we bought the stock for $22.88 a share. 6 months later, having missed the earnings estimate put out by Wall Street analysts, ATC had dropped to, yikes, $5 per share. Believing the company to be undervalued, we held on. Fortunately, we didn't add. We never add to our losers. We eventually liquidated what little value was left below $4 a share in October 1997. Reflecting on this, let me say first that any investor who takes any real risk investing in common stocks will have some spectacular losers. And no true rule-breaker investor should shy away from this reality. This style of investing is not for the faint of heart. And second, the good news here, the money that you make on your winners, if you are patient, should dramatically surpass what is lost on your losers. That's a lesson from our own experience. So with its large risks and rewards in mind, let's break down those six attributes we look for in every rule-breaker investment. Rule-breaker attribute number one, top dog and first mover in an important emerging industry. We buy only top dogs and first movers. Not the third player among internet search engines and not the second best tasting soda. How do you determine who's the top? Well, here are four ways. First, look at the company's market cap. The top dog is obviously going to be the company with the biggest market cap in its space. But hey, aren't we looking for smaller companies before they've been discovered by everyone and his Uncle Tony? So why are we looking for big market caps here? Well, it's all relative. You see, big market caps in young, rule-breaking industries